90-day period.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This is Richard Marsh. Counsel, while you are swapping out and getting settled, I'll remind you both that you have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellate will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we will be recording this. Yeah, I'm giving you some time to set up, and we will let people take seats in the courtroom as well.
That's
nice. Yeah, that's what I think.
Okay. Got it.
You will have a clear view of the monitor for your time. We can't see it, but we will assume that you're keeping track of your time. And again, counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Welcome to people who have now joined us to the Minnesota Court of Appeals in session today at the Brown County Courthouse. The next matter for argument is State of Minnesota versus Richard Marsh. And when you are ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
And state your name before we start talking. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Holly Burrell, and I'm a Special Assistant State Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Mr. Richard Ford Marsh, the appellate in this matter. There are many people of limited financial means who have no option but to live in informal, subdivided properties that may appear to be single-family residences from the outside. Individuals living in private, separate rooms on such properties must be afforded the same Fourth Amendment protections as everyone else. Those are the apt words of the Federal District Court in the United...
Put that microphone
on. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes. I wonder how I'm almost so visible or so audible for. Those are the words of the district court in United States versus Martinez, and they set the stage for the relief Mr. Marsh requests, which is to reverse the denial of his suppression motion and vacate the judgment of conviction below. There are two rationales for vacating the conviction. One is the invalidity of the warrant as overbroad as to Mr. Marsh, and second is finding that the search itself infringed Mr. Marsh's constitutional rights. Either ground alone will do, so I would prefer to focus on the second ground here.
And before you do that, just to go to the first ground, was that issue actually, the over-breath argument, was that actually preserved? Because we're strictly limited to what the pretrial issue was, and it seems that you're quite frankly trying to bootstrap that in by case law analysis of this issue that typically occurs, but it doesn't seem like the over-breath argument had been properly part of the pretrial submission.
No, I think it was preserved, and there are a number of reasons that I say that. The first is that the district court itself in the order denying the motion to suppress addressed that question and found that officers did not have enough information to reasonably believe didn't have information that would have required them to let the district court know that it was a multi-occupancy residence. So the district court did address that question in its order, and that was because in briefing that was submitted to the court, defense counsel devoted about 5 pages of the brief to the question of the validity of the warrant. In addition, I would say that in the...
But the district court said that the warrant was fine, and that wasn't really the dispute by the parties, was it?
So the question of whether the warrant was fine as to Dara Johansson, whether there was probable cause to search for evidence.
The warrant was for the entire residence, though.
That's correct. And so the question of whether it was valid overall as to Dara Johansson was not questioned, but the question of whether it was overbroad as to Mr. Marsh, because that information about him living there was never provided to the district court. That was preserved because it was briefed in defense counsel's brief, and it also came through in evidence in the disputed in the disputed contested hearing, and it was mentioned in the Rule 2601 agreement.
But isn't that really isn't the second issue the one that really is the relevant one as to what the police officers discovered once they arrived at the residence and went into the house? Not whether or not the warrant, when it first issued, was overly broad. Isn't that really the heart of the issue here?
It certainly is a crucial question here, yes, and I think it is perhaps an easier question to address because there was more information that became available during the search. There is case law asking whether officers should have, whether their investigation was reasonable in determining whether a building was multi-occupancy or not. And so that can be a question before the court. But here I agree that even if the court were to assume that the warrant was valid and was valid as to Mr. Marsh as well as Dr. Johansson, the actual target of the search, the court could still find that Mr. Marsh's Fourth Amendment rights were violated because officers came to know much more information during the actual execution of the warrant.
Well, and there were actually three warrants here, so let's step back. The first warrant, as I understand it, was issued based on concerns about firearms, weapons in this house attached to the homeowner or the person on the lease. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, okay. That's correct. There were shotgun shells found in the
And the occupant, the known occupant of the house, the renter, was someone because of whose criminal history was not eligible to possess firearms, correct?
The owner of the house, yes.
The owner. Okay. And as I understand it, the record, this is a two-story, single-family house, one mailbox, two ways, there are two doors in and out of the house, but nothing from the exterior of the house and nothing about how the house is listed for tax or zoning purposes suggested that it was anything other than a single family residence, correct?
It is. It does appear to be a single family home from the outside, and it is true that Dr. Johansson is listed as the only owner of the residence.
Was there anything that happened when the police came with the first warrant? And as I understand the facts, they were met by the renter at the door, or Miss Dharma, or whatever her name is, met by her at the door, or Johansson, and she tells them, yeah, here I am, it's my house, you might find drugs in the house, in my bedroom, and in response to a question, is there anyone else in the house, she identifies your client, correct?
She did identify the client, yes.
During that first encounter, and so at that point, the police, was there anything they learned, and at that point they left and got a second warrant so that they could look for drugs as well as weapons, correct?
That's in part correct. At that point, one of the officers, Agent Payne, went to get a second warrant specifically to find drugs relating to Mr. Johansson. But other agents then went in the house and went upstairs where they encountered Mr. Marsh in his room and saw Pavlov on the outside of the door.
Is the photograph, I think it's part of Exhibit 7, it's appended to your brief. There's a picture of a door there's a padlock that looks to be locked, but not through the hasp. Is that how it was at the time the officers arrived?
Yes, I believe so.
Was this picture taken, another way of asking my question, was this picture taken when the officers first got to the door? Do we know that?
I don't believe it was because Agent Isaacson testified that the door actually was closed more than it is depicted in the pictures when they first arrived. So I don't know exactly at what point they took a picture of the door. I don't think it was before they had knocked on the door and talked to Mr. Marsh.
Okay.
But I do believe, I don't know anything about whether the padlock had changed positions.
But it wasn't locked.
It was not locked when the officers arrived at the door because Mr. Marsh was in his room and a padlock can't be locked from the inside of the room.
Which kind of, I look at that picture and I can't, the doors look like it's seen better days and I can't really tell if, from looking at that, I can't tell if that's a padlock that's being used now or if it's something from years ago. It's hard to say.
Well, the undisputed evidence in the record and Mr. Marsh's undisputed testimony, uncontroverted testimony, is that he did use that padlock when he would leave his room to secure against access to anyone else.
Sure, but at the point that the police encounter the door, they don't know that.
That's true. However, they see a padlock hanging on the outside of the door, and a padlock is a clear sign that person Someone is able to close that door and will close it to secure access against other people. A padlock is accessible only by one person with one key. And the second fact that turns the tables here and puts the officers on notice that they were at risk of going into a private room, which is a test under Maryland v. Garrison. The second key fact here is that Mr. Marsh was in his room. Officers knocked, they didn't barge in, they knocked, and he told them, as Agent Isaacson testified, this is my room. So he informed them that this was his room,
but
and he refused
saying
to come
it's
out.
It's your room, though. I mean, how would that be any different than if you have children in your house and they padlock their room so their siblings, or better yet, their parents, can't get into the room when they leave? That's never happened before, right?
I think it would be a bit unusual to have children padlocking their door in a single family house. I can't speak to it personally. So this is not a family situation, however.
And then, he only announced that it was his room. He didn't say it was his private residence that he's renting out. And so how are police officers to know that? How is that rise to a level of privacy that one would expect be protected under?
Well, I think his actions also weigh into the consideration. So he refused to come out of his room and he refused to let them search it before officers convinced him that the warrant was valid as to his room. And I'll point out that this wasn't a casual conversation. Of course, officers had their guns out. They were announcing there was a warrant. And so I think his actions, as well as his words and refusing to let them search initially, is a fact that should have been taken into consideration. And the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. There's nothing in the record to indicate that officers asked very reasonable, we would say natural questions, such as, why is this your room? There's nothing to indicate that they asked if you rented, and I don't know that there's case law to support that it is the burden of a person to inform officers that they are a renter, tell them that he paid $120 every 2 weeks for the room, etc. Just as the conversation with Dara Johansson, the owner of the residence, there's nothing to indicate that after she said Marsh is upstairs, using a different last name, so indicating it's not her family member, there's nothing to indicate that officers asked the common sense, practical question, well, who is that?
Why would a police officer need to do that? I mean, I think generally when people are executing search warrants and ask who else is in the house, I mean, we assume they're asking for their own safety, for the safety of the officers executing the search, and so they know what they are getting into, how many people they need to secure before they conduct or complete their search. I'm not aware of any case law that imposes on officers who are executing a search warrant a requirement that they inquire of everybody they find in the place to be searched pursuant to the warrant, ask them what they're doing there and what their legal status is vis-a-vis that place to be searched. Are you aware of such a case?
I'm not aware of such a bright line rule, Your Honor, but it is, we have to judge the totality of the circumstances and take into account looking at it with a common sense approach. And here, in addition to these clear facts with the padlock and Mr. Marsh saying, this is my room and refusing to come out, there were a number of clues along the way that this was, in fact, a multi-occupancy home. And so while each...
As opposed to a community occupancy home, which case law distinguishes between, correct?
There is a distinction between that, that's correct. But the rationale for the community exception rule is that when people share communal space but do not secure their particular private spaces against access to others, that's where the police may be able to search when they only have a warrant for the entire building. Here, there were clear signs that this room, this particular room, held by Mr. Marsh, who was not mentioned in the warrant, was not mentioned in the affidavit, was one that he protected against access by other residents.
How do you get around the Gilbert case? I realize that that's an unpublished case, so it's not presidential. But there is pretty clear language. Well, actually, it's a very, very similar case to us. Actually, I think it's even more harmful to your position because there, the door actually was padlocked. And yet, this court agreed with the district court that that's only one factor that we look at. And there, they said, looking at the totality of circumstances, there still was not enough evidence. There was not enough information available to police officers for them to think that it was... that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy to that room.
So the Gilbert case is easily distinguishable because the case there, the police officers knew that there was a rented room in which Nelson was the girlfriend of Gilbert. They shared the room together. The police knew there was a rented room that Nelson rented with her boyfriend, and they mentioned that in the affidavit and in the warrant. And they also mentioned in that affidavit that drugs had been seen by the informant there in that particular room. So there was actual probable cause based, or there was at least a nexus to that room in the affidavit that was presented to the judge. Unlike here, where despite the fact that there was mail addressed to another person that was found in the trash, the affidavit mentioned only Dara Johansson, and it was based on her criminal history. So here, as the police were executing the warrant, and they get clue after clue, each one again, maybe not enough by itself, but all together, they add up to putting the officers on notice that they were at risk of going beyond the scope of a warrant to search for evidence of a crime by Ms. Johansson, because the padlock, Mr. Marsh's behavior, his words told them that this was a room in which he had a privacy expectation and Ms. Johansson did not have access. And I'll note, unless the court has any other questions and I'm running out of time, there is no question here that Mr. Marsh did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his room. The district court found that explicitly, and that finding has not been challenged on appeal. Unless there's any questions, I will take my time for rebuttal.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Megan Gaudette Coriel. I'm assistant Nicholas County attorney, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. Regarding the facts of this case, I don't believe many of the facts are in dispute. However, in appellant's brief, appellant does focus on one fact that I believe is not supported by the record. Appellant has made focused a lot on whether the interior lock on the door. Agent Isaacson testified he didn't see this lock. Appellant's testimony in the record is at best confusing as to whether the interior lock was actually engaged that day, but the district court specifically found that law enforcement did not encounter a secured locked door the day of the search.
Because it was open to some extent.
Yes, Your Honor, and even with the testimony that the district court had regarding the existence of the interior lock, the district court still found that. Whereas appellant has attempted to argue the interior lock was engaged, so it was locked to some extent, and it may be a minor difference. However, the district court did not differentiate between the existence of the padlock and the door. There's other things also not supported by the record. Appellant has stated that there's no familiar relationship between appellant and Ms. Johansson. I don't believe that was specified in the record.
I think that isn't the underlying issue and the facts that are relevant, whether the officers, while executing this warrant, reasonably concluded that this room was open to everybody in that residence, as opposed to a room that was unique to the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor.
So whether they're related or not is not as important as whether there was shared communal living and access by everyone to that part of the house, isn't it?
I would agree. And I raised the familial issue as courts have found that is one factor that may be considered. And so law enforcement did not take that reasonably. When law enforcement was informed that there may be someone else in the house with a different last name, I don't believe that by itself would be reasonable for law enforcement to say, okay, that's one more clue, if you will, that this may not be just a single.
Well, among other things, there are families that don't all have the same last name.
Correct. I do believe that the issue that was specifically preserved for this appeal is whether law enforcement unconstitutionally exceeded the scope of the warrant by searching appellant's bedroom. So I would be focusing my argument on that unless there is questions on another aspect. It is the state's position that law enforcement did execute the search warrant reasonably and the scope was not exceeded. Law enforcement did conduct reasonable inquiry either prior to the execution of the search warrant. Their agent Payne had conducted surveillance. There was these two trash bowls that did not reveal any evidence of appellant living at the residence. And by all external indicia, this was a single family residence. There was not multiple doorbells. There was not multiple mailboxes. There weren't separate ways to enter the second floor of the residence.
Counsel, let me stop you there. Everything you said up to that point, doesn't that really go to the whole breadth argument?
I don't think so.
Because some of the cases do talk about what information should the officers have had, what information the officers had and what they should have had prior to searching it, a residence to determine whether or not it's a single family residence, multiple, or it's a, is it registered as one that is going to be rented out to other people, even though on the outside it may look like a single family Victorian. See that oftentimes, especially around colleges and institutions. So doesn't that really go to the overbreadth of, shouldn't the police officers have had some indications beforehand that other people live there and have that search warrant narrowly tailored specifically to that owner who lived on the first floor, not others who lived upstairs?
Here, I do think it could go to both arguments. It does go to if law enforcement had observed those external indicia, but still went ahead with the warrant, it could lend to the overbreadth argument. However, it also goes to the reasonable inquiry done by law enforcement based upon plain observations of the residence. Once inside, there was no internal indicia besides the unlocked padlock that could indicate multiple occupants in the district court.
Wasn't there something in the record about some indication of identifying the room as well? I'm not sure if it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't like a sign or anything, but wasn't there something indicating that?
There was a number,
right? Yeah, a number on the room.
Appellant on page 44 of the transcript indecisively testified that there may be some markings in the corner of some of the rooms. He did not state that there was a marking on the room that he was found in. Agent Isaacson testified that the room was not marked with a number or letter identifying it as a separate unit, and that's on pages 9 and 10 of the transcript.
Well, he said he didn't see one. I thought he said he didn't see one, not necessarily that there wasn't one there.
I believe that is correct. And there's also a photograph which was exhibit 2 at the omnibus hearing. Even if there were a number there, Agent Isaacson did not see it. Therefore, it may not be reasonable for law enforcement to have may not be reasonable to expect that law enforcement would have to rely on that as an outward clue. Mr. Marsh himself said, appellant himself stated that even if there were markings, they may not have been large or obvious. He said something along those lines in the transcript. As other internal indicia that would indicate that this was not a multiple occupancy house was that there was open access within the entire house. There were shared common areas, which everyone had access to. The second floor, access was not restricted, and anyone in the residence could freely access it.
To the open areas, the common areas.
The state's argument is that everyone had access to the entire house. Yes, there was what was testified as a common area on the second floor that had a few kitchen-type items. There was no testimony it was a full kitchen or anything to that extent. But there was also a shared bathroom on the second floor.
There isn't a bathroom inside this door that has the lock on it.
Correct. There was no testimony and nothing to indicate that it was a self-contained unit with a kitchen inside, a bathroom, or anything indicating a studio apartment or any apartment type.
But doesn't the existence of the padlock, which, as I say, that door has a kind of a used look to it, but doesn't the existence of that padlock suggest that that is not a common area?
I don't believe so. There has, while not controlling case law, Anderson, which was cited in the brief, does state that even a lock by itself does not elevate a room to a separate residence. Gilbert, the door was locked, and that search was still upheld.
Gilbert, let's talk about Gilbert a little bit. I know about that.
You know about Gilbert.
Gilbert has a fact that is that in my mind distinguishes it from this case. In Gilbert, The warrant application specifically said there was going to be something found in Nelson's room. So when they got to the locked door and it turned out to be Nelson's room, although the warrant didn't say go into that room, the application on which the warrant was based was all about Nelson's room. That's not this case. This case is one where the landowner, the homeowner, the principal occupant of the house, is the one who was the focus of the warrant application and therefore of the warrant. So you get to this door, it's not like Gilbert in that respect. Do you agree?
I would, to the extent that, yes, in Gilbert there was some distinguishing facts. However, the items identified in the search warrants could have been found anywhere in the residence, including the appellant's room. The search warrant, the initial search warrant, was ammunition, which could be found anywhere in the home. The door was not locked.
If the padlock, if everything was the same in this case, but the door was locked from the outside with the padlock, would officers reasonably have been able to say this room, padlock room, is within the scope of our search warrant?
I would like to make sure I understand your question. So
yeah, if the door were locked.
Door were locked. I believe it would still be the same based upon the case law, again, Anderson, a Hawaii case. That was not enough to elevate a room to a separate residence. I believe that based upon the totality of the circumstances, and as the district court correctly found, there was no internal indicia besides this padlock that could indicate it was anything other than a single family residence. And so,
one of the problems of going to other jurisdictions is you find cases in other jurisdictions that sort of can be read both ways. It seems like Fleming out of Iowa could suggest otherwise.
And I believe that Gilbert had addressed Fleming and had
and distinguished Fleming
from it. There was, and I believe that the district court in its order had attempted to look at how other jurisdictions had handled this. I would agree that, you know, there is a lot of other jurisdictions. There is little controlling Minnesota case law. And so, yes, Fleming did at that time object the community living exception. However, this court has found the community occupation exception in Gilbert and in Lawrence. And I do submit that there are factual differences. However, there is also similarities there and with this matter.
This seems to be an area of law that could use some development in the state of Minnesota on the difference between a multiple occupancy building, which, you know, you have an apartment, former apartment building on one end, and a community occupancy building, which perhaps this is, perhaps this is not. You know, what legal approach, what rule of law, if you will, would you advocate for in terms of so that there would be better guidance to law enforcement and courts on how far a search warrant extends?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that elements of existing law can be applied in this matter, whether or not there was reasonable inquiry. I would submit that there was reasonable inquiry. So if you take the case law that exists about that, law enforcement did that, and there was nothing to indicate there was anyone besides Mr. Hansen. There was mail found from Mr. Olfat. There was testimony that he was in prison. I'm not sure. There's nothing in the record about beyond that open cell that I recall.
But wouldn't that be indicia that people other than the primary owner actually resides there? If they already did trash search and came across mail delivered to Mr. Olfat?
I think that would depend on whether law enforcement knew at the time whether Mr. Olfat was in prison. And I don't believe there's anything in the record about that. There was testimony that he was in prison, but beyond that.
But did police officers know at the time when they saw the mail, when they did the trash pull, did they know that he was in prison?
That's not the record, I don't know.
So if they did that, they did the trash pull and they see mail to somebody else there, isn't that indicia that other people, at least one other person, may be living in that? And then when you combine that with the fact when they approached the residence and they talked to the homeowner, and she said, yes, there's somebody else in there, and they go in, and they go upstairs, and they see that there are some like kitchen supplies on the second floor, which is a little unusual if it's just, why would there be that stuff up there across keep other people actually living out there, and then you come across this door that clearly has a padlock, and the padlock is actually hanging in the, and then you see somebody in there saying, hey, this is my room. Why isn't, looking at the totality of circumstances, why isn't that enough for the police officer to say, oh, wait a minute, you know what, this might actually be a place where other people are living in addition, and renting out, and have, as a district court found, that reasonable expectation of privacy?
Yes, Your Honor, so I'll attempt to take this step by step. So the first step, upon this mail from Mr. Olfat, it may have been different when Mr. Williamson said Olfat's upstairs. I think it can be inferred that law enforcement had checked as to whether Olfat was currently living in the house, if only for
obvious... Inferred?
If only... I would assume, I can't say that based upon the record, but based upon officer safety, if officers had discovered mail to someone else and the search warrant was for ammunition, you would think law enforcement would look into that person to know whether or not they may be encountering multiple people, what type of dangers, if you will, they will be encountering. As to the kitchen area, I don't know how unusual or uncommon it is to find kitchen items. It may be typical that certain people have mini fridges in certain parts of their house, or teenagers have food in their bedrooms. I know this is not a teenager, however, I think based upon the totality of all of those circumstances, there was still not enough for law enforcement to reasonably believe that this was a separate living or multiple occupancy situation. There's not any more questions, I will quickly answer.
The photo is in Exhibit 7, and in addition to the picture of the door and the lock, the photos that follow that show a room that's pretty much trashed. Was that as a result of the search, or was it that way before the search?
I believe that the record states that it was that way at the time of the search because Mr. Hansen was getting evicted from the residence, so they were moving out. I would request that the court find that the district court correctly determined that law enforcement search of the room did not exceed the scope of the search warrant, and I would respectfully request that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm going to start out by reminding the court that this is a totality of the circumstances test. So it is a difficult, it's tempting to try to apply bright line rules, such as in Anderson saying there was a padlock, and yet officers found that a padlock alone was not enough to establish a Fourth Amendment right that police officers should have been aware of. Here, of course, it was more than a padlock. There was a padlock. There was Mr. Marks in his room saying, this is my room, refusing to come out. There had been Mr. Johansson saying, Marsh is upstairs, indicating, therefore, that another person's in the building. There was a mail addressed to Mr. Olfat. There's the separate kitchen area upstairs. There's different...
Well, is it a separate kitchen area, or were there just some kitchen utensils? And it didn't seem like there was a full kitchen set.
I would agree there's no stove, there's nothing in the record to indicate there's a stove, but there's a refrigerator, there were dishes, there was silverware, there was food, and Agent Isaacson testified to noticing this.
But that was open to everybody who went upstairs to the second floor, right? People were not excluded from that. Your client didn't exclude other people from the area where the mini fridge or the dishes were found.
That's correct. I mean, there's no claim to Fourth Amendment privacy as to those common areas. The point about the kitchen is that, as in Simpson, for example, the Southern District of Indiana case, where on the second floor of that building, three-floor building, there was a common kitchen area and three bedrooms, very similar to the layout in this house. The court there found it important that there were at least three kitchens in a three-floor building, maybe even four. And so where there are signs that there's more than one kitchen area, and officers here, they came through the downstairs, they saw the downstairs kitchen, they came up, they see this other kitchenette area, that should be just another sign. Maybe this is an area where we have one of these informally subdivided homes. And I'll note as well that there's testimony from the city administrator of St. Peter's that although, of course, a building is supposed to be licensed as a rental unit, the city is aware that there are these informally carved up and rented out buildings.
Right, but if the police officers don't have that information beforehand, how does that help in terms of totality of circumstances analysis?
It helps because there are various indicators that are collected throughout time. In this case, putting, first of all, priming them to know there might be a multi-occupancy unit, such as the mail to Mr. Olfat, such as the fact that a different person than Mr. Hansen is in the building, Marsh, and then you add up all the different indicators, and in the totality of the circumstances here, particularly when officers get to that door, there's a padlock, and Mr. Marsh says, this is my room, I would argue that the reasonableness in this case is to find that officers should have gotten a second warrant. They were on notice of the risk that they were violating Fourth Amendment rights.
Both of you have cited two cases from other jurisdictions, and it looks like it's pretty clear that we don't really have anything published in Minnesota and not a lot of guidance. What would, I'm going to ask this question that Judge Durbin asked of the opposing counsel. What would your suggestion be in terms of guidance for courts and for litigants and police officers as to how to determine what is reasonable or not?
So I think the statement of the law in Maryland versus Garrison will remain probably the clearest framework that courts should apply as to whether a published decision here based laying out the different facts that would have put officers on notice that they were at risk of going beyond the bounds of the search warrant to search for evidence of one single person. If the court could lay out particular pieces of evidence that may provide guidance to police officers going forward, but I would submit as well, it's always going to be a totality of the circumstances test, and so it will be difficult to put one of those guidelines on. Here,
let me follow up on that question just with one sort of sub-question. Is the question of multiple occupancy versus community occupancy just a binary question, or can there be a residence that is partially community occupied and partially multiple occupied, maybe even this case?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but you may be correct, Your Honor, in that.
Well, I was asking a question.
Well, the rationale behind the community exception, community living exception, does not apply here, right? Where that is, everything is in communal and no parts of the house are secured against access to others, that no parts that are inhabited by particular people are secured against access to others. So if it is binary, then you would say here, where Mr. Marsh's room was secured against access to others, then it was now a multi-occupancy building, and I think that may be the answer here.
But can't that be, I mean, my house, when my daughter was 8, she locked herself in a room all the time to the point we had to threaten to take the door off. That's how often she did that. Mean, had someone issued a warrant for my house, it wouldn't have included her bedroom? I mean, the fact that you can lock a door, I mean, most residences have the push-button lock on the door, seems to me not enough of a distinguishing.
I would agree, a push-button lock.
It's the padlock in this case.
Or maybe different. It's the padlock. It says adults that are not related. It's the presence of a mini kitchen. It's the presence of mail to another resident who is not the person who is the target of the search. And it's the fact that here we have a search warrant that was narrowly tailored, or a search warrant that was focused on one person, Dara Johansson, and focused on her criminal
residence, though. And it wasn't a sign on the door saying, do not enter. High residents or was anything like that. So if, in terms of your suggestion of totality circumstances, there are other circumstances that are absent that could potentially be applied as well, right?
There could have been a do not enter sign, yes, but I think the padlock itself is that sign. The padlock is a clear indication that the room is securable and will be secure when a person is outside of the room and can actually lock it. I think my time is up unless the court has any further questions, Bonnie.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The case was well presented. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision in the statutory 90-day period. We are running ahead of time. This case is set for 11:30. Shall we take over and recess?
It's up to you, you're presiding.
I just want to
I don't know if the next people are in here.
I don't know if there's a check.
Would you like to take a break? Lee, or else we will take a short break. Good morning. You're here for the adoption case?
Yes.
All right. Running a little early, so we're just checking out in the hall to see if your counterparts are available.
Rush?
Okay. Could you give us instructions as to where we should go this afternoon?
I didn't. So we're up on the hill.
Yeah, I know where the building is, but where should we go?
So go in door one, and they'll have you come in.
Is that face the main road?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, so you'll come in.
I don't even know, is that highway? I don't even know what that road is.
Yeah.
It faces
Oak Street. You'll come in, on Oak Street.
Okay.
And then it'll be going door one, so you'll come up. And you'll be able to park in the guest parking spot.
Oh, there. Okay.
Yep.
And it'll be near that guest parking.
Yep. Okay. It'll be, so then you'll walk on the sidewalk to door number one and then just sign in with
me. I assume you need a badge or a tag or something.
Yep. Okay. And then I'll have, because I teach 6 hour, but I'll probably send a student down there. What time do you think he'll arrive?
I think about 2. Okay. Maybe a little before.
Yep.
We have to finish this and then probably roll lunch and talk about some stuff. So yep. Probably right around 2.
Sounds excellent.
Okay. Door number one.
Yes.
2 o'clock.
Thank you.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
First year there, he let me off easy. And afterwards, like, yep, it's yours now.
Mr. Kansas, this is the way of the smudging. Or you can leave it by me depending on how strong the book is.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, I was gonna be there.
Is it just a question of me right now, or?
Yeah, this is just home to my audience, so if the courts are proceeding that way.
Do you have your phone? Can you, do you want to go up and try to contact him and see if he's close by?
You came up with the first. Was it still that? I'll say for both of them. I probably just in case, but yeah.
Do you have some questions, I guess? You kind of.
Start reading every, on the spell check.
Please rise.